increase our technology, which allows us to give you more service and educate the people, which was something that Mr. Toyama was saying was incredibly important. So please remember all of that when you move to your phone and consider starting a new monthly donation. You know, whether that's $5 a month or $50 a month, it's most important that you get involved and let us add you to the good books. Call right now, 877-500-5266. If you're anywhere in North America, you can do that toll-free. Anywhere in the world with a wired box, you can make that donation at KBOO.FM. And we've got more radio coming up, I reckon.
Yes, we do. Thank you, son. Thank you, Justin. Stay tuned at 10 o'clock for Air Cascadia on KBOO. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints follows, and then at 11, it's The Dirtbag with host Glenn Andreessen. And right now, we're going to go to Kathleen Stevenson speaking with Kate Harding about her book, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives. I'm with writer Kate Harding. She is the author of the new book, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. Kate is the co-author of Lessons from the Fatosphere and a contributor to the Book of Jezebel. Kate Harding, welcome. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Why did you want to write this book?
A couple of reasons. One is that I am a rape survivor. About 23 years ago now, I was raped in college. And so it's something that has obviously been close to my heart since then. But also around 2012, when I started working on this, it just seemed like there were so many instances of rape culture showing up in the news every day without anyone kind of connecting the dots between these things and calling it that. And so that was things like Todd Akin and his legitimate rape comments, the Steubenville rape story. And, you know, just very kind of silly, thoughtless things that politicians were saying, that celebrities were saying, that really made me think, okay, I want to do something about rape culture in general and connect these dots a little more, as I said.
Yes, and you referenced the fact that that was before the Bill Cosby publication of the charges against Bill Cosby.
You know, the interesting thing is, it was obviously before Bill Cosby became huge national news this time around. It was not, however, before I should have known about it. And I didn't, in my research, granted I didn't go looking for this in particular, but completely missed the fact that it was, I think, 2003 or 2004 that these 13 women filed suit against him.
Well, we might come back to Bill Cosby in this discussion, but let's get some basics covered first. How do you define rape culture?
I define it as a culture that supports and protects rapists more than victims, and that consistently fails and isolates victims. And by that, I mean, it is a culture where a rapist knows that his victim is very unlikely to even report, let alone launch a successful prosecution against him. And it is a culture where we blame the victims, where we presume that any woman who reports a rape has a 50-50 chance that maybe she's just lying about it. All of those things where when we hear that someone has been accused of rape, our immediate response is, oh, he couldn't do that. I like him. I think, you know, he's a great comedian or he's a great hockey player. We don't think, well, those things can be true in addition to he is also a rapist.
Is that because we have myths about rape, or why is that?
Yes. So the academics who work in this area talk in terms of rape myths and rape myth acceptance. And those are things like she was asking for it, like anyone who really wants not to be raped should be able to fight off her attacker. And then interesting things that sort of contradict each other, like rape is a deviant event, but also a trivial event. So it's highly unlikely that you will be raped, but then if you are, it's no big deal. And so it's really interesting that it's kind of, I don't believe you, but also you were asking for it, but also it was no big deal. Like, which is it, really?
You make a statement in the book that I'd like you to maybe elaborate on, and that is, every American boy is at risk of growing up to become a rapist. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
And I couched that in terms of, you know, this is going to be the line that, you know, anti-feminists put across my face on pictures they send around as memes. It's not that I think that, you know, boys have this fundamentally, like, rape-prone nature. It's that I think because we live in a rape culture And because rapists are not just the strangers who jump out of the bushes, they are our friends and family members, and that there are the sociopaths, but then there are also people who just grow up with this toxic sense of entitlement to women's bodies. And we don't know who those are going to be when they're sweet little boys. And we don't want to believe it when they grow up and they're good kids who get good grades in school and they're athletic and all of that. And oh, by the way, they also force themselves on women on the weekends. All of this is set up so that we don't believe it could ever be those good kids. And the reality is, good kids rape. And we don't know who they're going to be. So that's why I'm very much in favor of education about consent, about healthy relationships, about dating violence as early as possible, basically.
And that's one thing we should say about this book, Asking for It. It's not just all about how bad the culture is, how bad the experiences have been. It is about areas where there is hope and some things that are being proposed or being done that are impacting this rape culture.
Right. Honestly, I have my publishers to thank for that. Because when I started it, you know, I'm angry about a lot of this stuff, and that certainly comes through, and that I was really thinking of just writing a descriptive book of, like, I want to articulate this problem in a way that people can understand. And my publisher said, like, you can't do that. You have to give them, like, some kind of hope. And what can we do? And that really forced me to think of it in those terms more than I had, where initially my thought was, well, it's just this terribly complex problem and I can describe it to you, but somebody else can figure out what to do. Mm. And it was good for me, I think, too, to see so much of what people are doing to try and make changes. And that was really heartening to me, and I hope it will be to the reader as well. Part of what gives me hope is how connected we are, how victims are not isolated the way they used to be, because even if their communities and the people around them don't believe them or don't support them, you can go online and very easily find a bunch of people. There's even a wonderful site called I Believe You, It's Not Your Fault, that is just for that, just for particularly young people who have been victims of rape or incest, to write in and say, here is my story, and have, you know, adults who have also been through it come back and say, we believe you, it's not your fault. That's an enormous thing that was never there for victims before.
You are listening to Kate Harding. She is the author of the new book, Asking for It. It's a smart and sometimes actually funny book about our culture and how we understand rape. And we are offering this book as a thank you gift when you call 877-500-5266. This is Political Perspectives. I'm Kathleen Stevenson. And you take on the whole issue of wanting to prevent someone from being falsely convicted. You take that on in a straightforward manner. And I wanted to talk about some of the issues related to that. One of them is, what percent of reports of rape are estimated to be false?
The best estimates, based on essentially the best designed studies at this point, come down somewhere between 2 and 8%. And the low end of that is comparable to false reports of muggings or burglaries. It's hard to say because there are lots of different studies, because different police departments have different standards for saying that an accusation is unfounded or that it's false. And so it's hard to pin down that number, but it certainly seems to be well under 10%.
Yeah, you write about some departments and categorizing of unfounded.
Right, yeah. Sometimes it's just gut instinct. I don't believe she's telling the truth, so poof, it's unfounded. And often what happens, actually, that's extremely sad, is that a real victim will come in, will report it, start to have the experience of reporting it, which is that you are then investigated almost as if you were a criminal. And or if it's someone you know, if it's an intimate partner, it's very common to then recant or just withdraw the charge and just say, I don't want to pursue this anymore. And sometimes those are then marked as unfounded cases, where it's not that she says it didn't happen, it's that she says, I just don't want to pursue this. And when we live in a culture that makes it incredibly hard for victims to pursue it all the way to try and arrive at justice for what's happened, it's completely understandable that people wouldn't want to.
So talk about the issue of assuming the accused rapist is innocent. Talk about that and some of the broader issues surrounding that.
we tend to, when we hear about a reported rape, part of what rape culture does is it encourages us to identify with the person who is accused of rape rather than identifying with the victim. And what I mean by that is we immediately think, oh, what if this isn't true? Because we don't want to believe it about a person that is, you know, in some way likable or admirable to us. So immediately we want to find a way to believe that it isn't true. And then that leads to the victim blaming. It leads to the trivialization of it. And so we trivialize and blame and do everything we can to believe that this person couldn't have done it, because our knee-jerk response is to think, oh, wouldn't it be terrible if I were falsely accused of rape, and not, wouldn't it be terrible if I were raped? Mm-hmm. And that's something that makes it very hard for victims to come forward, because they know that that's going to happen. It happened to me to an extent, because I was raped by a man that I met at a college party, and we were drinking and dancing, and then we went and I thought I was going to make out with him, and then it turned into him raping me. And I didn't get his name. But the next day in the dining hall, it was a very small campus, I saw him and I said to the woman I was with, oh my God, that's the guy. And she said, oh, I know him. No way, that's the guy. And then I thought, okay, well, I can't even trust my own memory of that. And that that was the face that was right there last night, because someone just told me he couldn't have done that. Now, later on, when we found out that he had also raped other people, that friend was mortified and incredibly apologetic. But that is the knee jerk. And it wasn't even a matter of, like, she'd spent a lot of time with him, knew him really well. It's just the knee jerk response. I've had a beer with that guy. No way is he a rapist.
And yet, you, like, one of the main themes of your book is for people to think in terms of the victim. What if she was someone, what if the victim was your daughter, your sister?
Yes. And I think that's an important thing for men especially, to be able to think of it happening to women that they love, in terms of breaking down the stereotype of the person who reports a rape as a slut and a gold digger and all of that. But I also ask people to go further and say, you know, don't just imagine that it was someone you love who was raped. Imagine it was you, because that's what will get us over that hurdle of always identifying with the perpetrator instead of identifying with the victim. If we say, okay, well, what if someone violated my bodily autonomy in this way and there was essentially nothing I could do about it, and they could get away with it and they could go on and continue doing it to other people because there are so few systems in place to support victims of this kind of crime, how would I feel then?
And one of the things I liked about your book was you, as I said, you took on this issue of false accusations and or, well, let's just say the Central Park jogger, sure, where those men were, it wasn't like they were accused by her because she didn't know what happened, but they were assumed to be guilty. And then
they were presumed to be guilty. And that was an interesting case study because, again, it didn't come from the victim's accusation at that point. It came from shoddy police work and aggressive prosecution that was carried out in a very racist way, and the presumption that these young black and brown men who had been out having a good time and maybe committing some petty crimes in the park, mm-hmm, that they must have been the ones who raped her instead of actually going out and looking for the person who did it. And why I included that is in part because, you know, we think of false accusations as being a problem of the, you know, lying bitches. And it's actually, for it to get to the point where it can really, you know, ruin an innocent person's life, it takes a whole system of people. It takes police and prosecutors and a community and a jury and a judge all coming together and going in the wrong direction. And you see that in things like the Duke LaCrosse case, where that did start with a woman lying, but there were a million red flags where they could have shut down that investigation and realized. And it's so ironic that so many actual rapes go unreported or unprosecuted, that women who have actually been raped, and that's later shown by DNA evidence, have then themselves prosecuted for filing a false report because the police just didn't believe them. Yet somehow everyone believed Crystal Mangum, even though she was high, she was slurring, she was saying names of men who weren't there. It was very strange that they picked that one, and that prosecutor then just ran with that and just decided, this is what I'm going to make my name on, and ignored a zillion places where he could have stopped with that and was later disbarred. So that's, you know, the way I put it is, it takes a village to convict someone falsely.
You say that CDC researchers found that only two primary prevention strategies have demonstrated significant reductions in sexual violence behavior. What are they?
They are two specific programs that are aimed at younger kids, so around junior high or maybe early high school level, as opposed to college, which is where a lot of people get their first kind of sexual assault awareness programming. And there are programs that take place over a period of 6 or 8 weeks. So there is an ongoing discussion, and it's a nuanced discussion, as opposed to show up for an hour or take an online test that I know is what my nephew was doing for their sexual assault awareness at his college. And so these are things that give those kids, as I was saying, that education in dating violence, because it's often your intimate partner who will be the one who rapes you. It's about healthy boundaries, about what consent looks like, and how to just interact with people in a healthy way, so that it breaks down not only that sense of entitlement to someone else's bodies that boys growing up in rape culture get, but it breaks down the social cover for other rapists, because you would then have a generation of young men and women who know what consent looks like, who know the difference between affirmative consent and an enthusiastic partner and someone who is just not able to. Mm-hmm. And so that makes it less likely that people will believe if somebody says, oh, she wanted it. Like, no, dude, how did you know she wanted it? Like, it shifts that blame from what if she's lying to, wait, how did you know? What was she doing that indicated that she wanted it? And especially when the answer is, well, she was basically asleep or half passed out, it seems really unlikely that that person actually did want it.
This is Political Perspectives. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and my guest is writer Kate Harding, author of the new book Asking for It, which is available as a thank you gift if you call this hour and make your pledge of support to KABU. The Steubenville assault, the Steubenville rape, when you talk about that and you relate that there was this young man who was sort of on the phone, I guess, watching what was going on and commenting on it in a joking way when she was totally unconscious and being gang raped. And, I mean, it was horrific to read what he said. On the other hand, there were, in the recording, there were these voices of at least a couple young men who said, that's wrong, that's rape.
Right. And so this is someone who had graduated from Steubenville High School. And I don't think it was real time exactly, but it was a video of that had been committed. So there's this 12-minute video of this kid watching it while somebody films him, and he's just making wisecracks and, oh, she's a dead girl, and you know. And mostly people are not challenging him until it just goes on and on. And finally, a couple other guys in the room do say, bro, that's like rape. And one of them says, I have a 16-year-old sister. And what if that were, you know, he says the name of some woman that this guy apparently knows. And that really gave me more hope than I expected to get from watching that video. I actually put off watching that video for a long time because I knew that was going to be hard to watch, even though I had read a lot of news accounts of it. But when I finally went and looked at it, I saw, you know, at least there are two guys in the room saying that. What's sad is that I think it's much easier for guys to say it when they're watching a video than when they're watching it happen in real time, mm-hmm. when you would actually have to confront someone and say, wait a minute, this is messed up. And what you see in gang rape situations like that, going back to, you saw it in the Glen Ridge, New Jersey one that's in the book Our Guys, that was about a bunch of baseball players who raped this girl with cognitive disabilities. And going through all of these famous instances of a gang rape like that, what you see is there are guys who walk away and they don't necessarily intervene, but they know that it's messed up and they don't want to be there for it. And part of what consent education can do is help those guys find it within themselves to actually intervene and stop it instead of just trying to get out of the room. And I shouldn't even just say guys, because there were women around, or young girls, as it were, in the Steubenville case as well.
And maybe this would be a time where we talk some more about the actions that you see as hopeful student activism and the challenge that colleges have now to live up to Title IX or the Clery Act. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So Title IX has been around for a long time, saying that, you know, everyone has the right to an education without sexual discrimination. It's only recently that people sort of figured out, wait a minute, that means I also have the right not to be raped on campus, and the colleges have more of a responsibility to make sure that that doesn't happen. And so student activists have done a lot of work with this, where some of them put together this wonderful website called KnowYourIX.com. And there's a form there that you can submit. So say a report that this happened, that I think that my college should be under investigation. And in fact, now dozens of colleges are under investigation for Title IX violations, specifically relating to sexual assault and rape. And before, there had been none. So that's a big change that's happened just in the last few years. And of course, the specter of the Title IX investigation is making a whole lot of other colleges get their acts together and say, what can we do? The problem, of course, then is that it's hard to figure out what to do, especially when we see that, like I said, the prevention education needs to happen at an earlier age than college. It will be a while of people figuring out what works and how to help it. But the fact is, colleges are on notice that you can't just pretend this doesn't happen. And there was just, Michael Kimmel wrote an article in The Atlantic recently discussing research where college presidents were asked, do you think rape on campus in general at other campuses is a problem? Well, yes, it's a widespread problem. Do you think rape is a problem on your campus? And something like 6% of them said yes. So we really still have to break through that denial at the highest levels that it's happening on every single campus.
And the Yes Means Yes campaign, can you say a little bit about that?
Sure. So it's something that has actually become law in California. It became law that all colleges who receive state funding in California, that they have to investigate claims of rape with an affirmative consent standard instead of the old no means no, which is to say exactly what I was talking about before, that the guy is expected to be able to say, well, here are some indications that she was an enthusiastic partner, as opposed to just, well, she wasn't fighting me off, because she wasn't fighting me off isn't good enough. They have also just recently made affirmative consent education at the high school level a statewide initiative, which I think is just hugely important. And the resistance to it blows my mind, where I was taking commenters from Twitter today saying, you know, oh God, Kate Harding is just trying to get rich off of writing about rape and this affirmative consent is ridiculous. Why would anyone want a partner who's not enthusiastic? And the idea that we're taking away something from people, something they have a right to, by saying that if you have sex, the other person should be into it, that is really frightening to me. You know, they're lots of kinds of sex that are healthy and consensual and have nothing to do with rape. And enthusiastic consent should be the minimum standard for all decent people, whether it's a law or not. And honestly, I think that is how most of us are having sex, that most of us would never be interested in a partner who isn't clearly willing. And I think it's insane that we want to give cover to rapists that way by saying that affirmative consent is somehow this onerous burden that no one should have to deal with.
Well, it sounds funny, but I did enjoy reading your book, you. Asking for it. It's a thoughtful book. So thank you, Kate
I
Harding.
I hope so. Thank you, Kathleen.
I've been speaking with Kate Harding about her new book, Asking for It. The subtitle is The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. And as I've said, Kate Harding's book is available as a thank you gift with your pledge of $60 per year to KBOO. And now we're joined by some friends to tell us more about how to support Political Perspectives and KBOO today, and how you can get a copy of the book, Asking for It, with your pledge of support to this station.
Thanks so much, Kathleen. Yes, we do want to send you, dear listener, a copy of Asking For It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. If you could just start or renew your modest contribution at $5 a month or more, we can send that to you, this book by Kate Harding. And you can do that by calling us right now at 877-500-5266. You can do that online at kboo.fm, or you can come in person to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Kathleen, that was a really important interview, and as I was listening to that, I was thinking to myself of the difference between mainstream media and independent voices like this, because it seemed to me that you get the difference between, clown quotes here, rambunctious boys versus rape culture, gang criminal assault, and the difference couldn't be any more stark. That must have been a difficult interview to do.
Well, actually, it was not that difficult because she lays out the issues in the book really well, and obviously she's able to talk about it really well too. And it was very informative for me, as I mentioned. It was a thoughtful book, and it was actually kind of funny. I mean, she does have funny elements in the book, which make it kind of a relief when you're reading about some of these horrific acts. So I think it's a very important book, and I really appreciate it. She came into KBOO yesterday when she was here.
Nice. Well, we can put that book in listeners' hands by starting or renewing your monthly contribution, $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever works for you, when you call toll-free 877-500-5266.
And remember, you can also donate online at kboo.fm/give. And we'd like to thank Ira from Beaverton for renewing his membership. Thank you, Ira. Deborah from Tigard, who is also renewing her membership, but she also increased her monthly deduction. So thank you very much, Deborah. And that is a very simple way to also give. If you're already doing your monthly contribution, please increase it by $1 or $5. 877-500-5266. And if you're giving at the $60 level or more, get the book, Asking For It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. And that's who we're listening to Kathleen Stevenson talking with. She's talking with the author, Kate Harding. And you can get that book, 877-500-5266. Also want to thank Karen, who's a renewing member from Portland. And Greg and Michelle, also both from Portland, they both came into KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and made their donation.
I have to say, I'm still thinking about the difference between our independent voice working to serve the community versus mainstream media basically working to get advertisers. And I have noted that this conversation is arriving to mainstream media. We're talking about this. I mean, we see the same thing when it's Anglo children are burning down their frat house versus Ferguson, right? Rambunctious boys versus thugs. But another thing I was thinking about, Kathleen, as we were listening to this interview, was just the title of Ms. Harding's book here, What We Can Do About It, as opposed to the wringing of the hands. You know, for example, John Oliver pointed out recently, there's been, one guy tries to light his shoes on fire on the airplane and we have to take off our shoes, but tens of thousands of gun deaths later and nothing is being done. Does Kate Harding have comments on this?
I don't know that she talks much about gun culture, but she does talk about just how changes will be made. I mean, that is really the heartfelt part of the book, the part of the book that makes yourself as a reader feel like there are some workable solutions, some things that can happen. So that was quite good about reading the book. And she talked in the interview about not at the beginning thinking she was going to put that into the book. So that was really a good part of the book, and I do recommend it to people who might want to call right now and give us a call of support at 877-500-5266 and support KBOO at the same time. Keep us going. Keep this kind of programming on the air. Keep concepts that are really important to be discussed in the airwaves right now by calling 877-500-5266.
It seems like another example to me that if we don't do it, it doesn't get done. And we're doing it right now, and we're just asking all the listeners to make sure that they're doing their part and making modest contributions to keep this information going out to people, or else it doesn't get out to people. And we're asking you to remember to follow the money. We hear that all the time. And here at KABU, you can follow the money right from your house, right to our house. 83 cents of every dollar that we have came from you, the listener. So please make sure that you've done your part today by calling 877-500-5266. And when you get a copy of this book, you become one of the teachers. Who teaches the teachers? KABU does. And then you get this book and you take it out and you expand this information in your community. Toll free, 877-500-KBOO.
And yeah, pick up your copy of the book, as Justin was saying, 877-500-5266. And then we have a modest goal of $500 for the top of the hour. And for we'd like to get four more callers at 877-500-5266 before we go to Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. And remember, become a monthly donor today. On average, our monthly donors give us about $11.50 a month, and about 44% of our members give to us this way, which gives us very stable funding, secure funding. It's very easy to set up, either through your checking account, or we're more than happy to take it from your debit or credit card on the first of each month. You can also give at kboo.fm/give. And let's move on over to Air Cascadia.
Thanks, Sun, and thank you, Justin. Thanks, Kathleen. And we're going to move to Air Cascadia with Chris Andre in just a moment after an important message. Stay tuned at 10:15 for Flashpoints. Randy Credico talks about being on the front lines fighting to control police violence and the prison industrial complex. And then at 11 on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen welcomes back John Seltvedt to talk about his productive gardening style, edible weeds, food forests, and medicinal plants. And as I said, it will be momentarily time to go to Air Cascadia. It's 10 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO.
KABU would like to thank the restaurants that donated food for our volunteers today. Kenny and Zooks for providing breakfast. They have three locations in Portland serving pastrami, bagels, sandwiches, and other deli items. Located at 1038 Southwest Stark, 3901 North Williams, and 2376 Northwest Thurman. Apriza Mexican Cuisine for providing lunch. Serving Mexican cuisine for takeout and drive-thru in a recycled shipping container located at